Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm going to record this. I should tell recording you, I'm going to record this, Eugene, just in case you're under it. You're under the illusion that I wasn't going to record it. It was just going to be a little private chat between the two of us
that no one will ever hear.
Yeah. I just wanted to talk to you, Eugene.
It's the Keith Walsh podcast. It's essential like your breakfast. It will get you up and going, learn some things you didn't know. Yeah, it's the Keith Walsh podcast. It's the Keith Walsh podcast. Give you energy like Buckfast. And if your head's in a pickle or you're looking for a giggle, it's the Keith Walsh podcast.
Yeah. So, welcome to the Keith Walsh podcast. Our guest today is Eugene O'Brien, who has written for stage, screen and radio. His work includes the critically acclaimed TV drama Pure Mule, winner of 5 IFTA Awards, which according to the Irish Times spectacularly raised the bar for Irish TV drama. I wonder if they reached those heights since, I'm not sure. The show was inspired by his play Eden, which debuted at the Abbey and has since played the West End and Off-Broadway. It won the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature in 2003. The film adaptation won Best Actress for Eileen Walsh at the Tribeca Film Festival. A new play, Heaven, set in the same fictional Midlands town, debuts at the 2022 Dublin Theatre Festival. And Eugene is a regular columnist at the Sunday Independent. This is his first novel, which I was surprised by. This is called Going Back. And on the top of the book, the front of the book, it says, Scobie Donoghue's run out of road. And now he's got to go back. This is your first novel, Eugene.
It is indeed. Yeah. It was a very different experience writing a book. I'm a drama kind of lad, so it's film and TV and stage. So writing a book was a completely different animal, and I was greatly helped. I had a great editor. Gill Publishers gave me a great editor, and I learned on the job, as they say, which is the best place to learn. I think they kind of came about because they'd seen Pure Mule during the pandemic. The RTE showed loads of stuff again. And there was kind of a new interest in the show, and it was fantastic. A lot of younger people start watching it. And so Gail kind of rang me up and said, would you be interested in doing a book? And I was the one who said I'd actually, because they said you can write about anything. And I said, no, I've had this idea, but I'd love to revisit the Bell Scobie Donoghue, who was in Australia for 10 years. I'd love to see what he's doing. And he was at that kind of awkward age, 39 going into 40. Which I found a very difficult age personally, which it's a good a few years ago since I passed that threshold. So I just wanted to get into him again. So they gave me the opportunity to do that, and it was great.
So that was this story of Scobie and catching up with Scobie. That was something that kind of had been in your head, and then just lockdown, Pure Mule being shown on the TV again. That all just kind of like. It was like almost like the perfect storm. Like it all just kind of came together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hadn't got a story in mind about Scobie. I wasn't kind of lying in bed at night going, I must write about Scobie. But it just when they said this book thing idea, I went, you know something. I had a few ideas. I went, this is a really good excuse to go back into his world and life, and And I was finding lockdown really great for writing. I got an awful lot of work done during lockdown. I wrote a film and the play that's out soon and this novel. And so just a very productive time because that's what I do. Writers are stay at home, locked in a room anyway. It didn't make that much difference in my life. It's kind of sad, But no, there was no distraction really at all. You were just out here. There was time to fill. So you just kind of went at it,
can we go back then to Eden? And I suppose, I'm going to say the start of it all, but you can correct me and say, no, I did loads of stuff that just didn't get the recognition before Eden. But, I mean, you left Eden Derry, you were quite young. Like, did you leave at 17?
Well, I was a young lad. Yeah, I went, I was always kind of the youngest in my class, whatever, that kind of, whenever I was born, you know, October, but I was in, I went into babies when I was 3, I think, you know. And then high babies when I was 4. Anyway, but so I left to come to to college in Rathmines in College of Commerce. There was a communications course there, so I went up there in 1985, and it was crazy kind of course. It was run by the great Lelia Doolan, and it was very creative and a lot of tension in the air and a lot of lecturers who had experienced the kind of revolution of the 60s and were disillusioned. But it was certainly a baptism of fire, you know, for us coming up from the country, you know. And there was fellas yelling up, talking about Goddardian distance and yelling fuck you at each other, and you know, it was all hilarious, but
dramatic.
Oh yeah, totally. And so I did 3 years there, and some of it was good, some of it was terrible. But we got to learn how to make films, and we actually made 16 mil films in third year, and that was great. And I was always acting a lot, you know, behind the camera a lot, and writing a bit. But and then I kind of started acting after college then, and acted for about 10 years, jobbing actor, did, you know, a few shows in the Abbey, did toured the country with things, did Fair City for a year and a half. All that kind of stuff. And I was writing as well, you know, I was writing a one-man show. Myself and a friend went to America in 1987, and we traveled across for 6 weeks, and we ended up meeting the famous beat writer, William Burroughs, in the middle of Lawrence, Kansas. And we spent 3 hours at William Burroughs and smoked his grass and got locked out of our minds on vodka. And it was kind of an extraordinary experience. So I'd written a kind of show about that, this show, myself and a friend traveling in America and experiencing a very divided country then as well. You know, it was during the Oliver North trials, the arms around Contra affair, you know, people going out T-shirts of Oliver North, American hero. And then other people thinking he was the devil. And, you know, so it was a very interesting trip. So I wrote a one-man show about that, like in the style of Spalding Gray. He used to write these incredible monologues, swimming to Cambodia, and very influenced by him. And then in about 1995, I wrote a one-man that I put on. And within that, there was a story about a married woman and in a town who has a one-night stand with a guy traveling through the county. And that became the basis for Eden, which I wrote then in about 99, 2000. And then the Abbey put that on in 2001. And I suppose that was kind of life-changing because, you know, it really was an incredible experience. It seemed to really, it just hit a nerve, and I was no longer acting, and I had a kind of writing career. People were asking me to write stuff, and you know, so that it all kind of started from there, really.
I'm absolutely blown away that you mentioned William Burroughs, because I mean, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, but the way you write, and especially with Eden, is stream of conscience. Like it's very much like I'm a big fan of Kerouac. Anybody who had any notions about themselves living in a Midlands town is a fan of Kerouac. But I'm really attracted to that style of writing. And I loved that, you know, the fact that the characters never actually talk to each other, but it's all just stream of consciousness. But also it's just in the style of writing. It's like it's as real as you can get. And it's in the moment. And it's just so vital as well, you know. I'm fascinated that you mentioned Burroughs, you know, because it's that style, isn't it?
Well, it's that style. I mean, he was very out there, and, you know, he did the cut-up technique where he would write the stuff out and then he'd cut the paper up and fold it. And I think another friend of his had invented that. I mean, Joyce really was the granddaddy of all that stuff. So the Burroughs stuff, we just were big fans of in college, and we liked, because we were kind of snobby art students, we liked the fact that no one else liked it and no one else could understand it, you know, man.
Yeah. Were you wearing black we were in black turtlenecks and smoking
almost,
cigarettes?
Yeah, almost. I had a long black coat, you know.
Perfect. And, was it Crombie? Was it a Crombie?
It wasn't quite, I don't know what it was. It was a shit out coat anyway, and I used to kind of wear it and would be kind of pouncing around the place. But no, it was great. I mean, but the great thing about college is that you met your own tribe. You met all these people who had the same interests as you and listened to the same music, and kind of that was a great revelation to me. Do you know what I mean? That there was others out there who liked all this stuff. And so myself and my friend then said, we're going to go to America and just hitch around the place and you know, see could we meet him. I mean, it was an ambition. We'll go to Lawrence, Kansas. We know he lives there, and we see can we meet him, and we ended up meeting him, and it was kind of mad. Yeah.
So how, what was it like then for you to just go up to him and say, can we just, I once met Ian Brown from the Stone Roses and on the street in London, and I said, can we go back to your hotel and hang out with you? And he just had bought a pre-packed sandwich from Spar, and he was just said, I'm listening. He was like, I'm just going back to eat my sandwich, man. And
well, there's going to be no, you know.
And I was like, but your life must be insanely brilliant. Can we go back and hang out with you? He was like, I'm just going to sit in my hotel room, watch television, and eat the sandwich. So he wasn't having any of it. So how did you get to hang out with him? How does that happen?
Well, we just kind of arrived. We got on the Greyhound bus for 4 days, and we ended up kind of meeting this US Marine on the bus, young guy, and he was going back to LA. Anyway, we ended up going back to LA where we didn't mean to go to, but he had invited us to kind of stay with him, and that was a whole other story. But anyway, we ended up getting off the bus 2 days later in Lawrence, Kansas, and we went up to the university to ask the university had Burroughs done work up there, had he any, and we met this crazy American film lecturer called Chuck Berg. I remember Chuck. He kind of talked very quickly, like a kind of a Martin Scorsese, you know, but like on speed or something, and he was talking about Oliver North, and it was all this stuff, but in the heel of the reel, he kind of liked us, and he gave us a number that he shouldn't have given us, we found out later. And we rang the number. We went to this very trendy bar. Lawrence, Kansas is a very trendy town. It's like not cornfields and, you know, mid-America. It was a very trendy university town. And there was a bar there called the Woodchuck, and you could smoke dope around it. And it was all very, you know. So we rang this number, and this kind of high-pitched gay voice came on the other side, and it was, hi, I'm Michael. And Michael was James Gunnerhertz's young lover, who was Burroughs's editor. And Michael was looking after Burroughs. And so he was talked to us for a little while, and then he said, oh, okay, if you hang up by the Woodchuck, I'll come and get you in 15 minutes, and you can come meet William. And we just were going... We thought it was a send-up, you know, we couldn't believe it. And then he was a little late, and then we thought he wasn't coming. Anyway, he arrived up. Hi, guys, jump in. And we drove through Lawrence and out to this little house, one-story little house with a Waltons-type door, swing door. And we went in, the sun was coming through the window, and Burroughs was sitting on the couch. Yes, hello. And he had all his little cats. He called them his little beasts. And he was putting flea powder on all these little kittens. And we sat with him, and your man went and got shots of vodka, and then he rolled joints, and I rolled this out the back. And we kind of talked to him, but he was like an alien. I mean, he was like someone I have never quite experienced since. Do you know what I mean? He came in with the gun into the room, considering he shot his wife and everything, but he came in with the gun and he showed us his shotgun art and these huge tomatoes that he was growing. He loved growing these huge tomatoes, and you want to come out and see the tomatoes? So it was kind of very bizarre.
Wow. I don't know, that's that's amazing. That is absolutely amazing. I just like, there's something, the younger me, I'm just like that. I want to have had that experience. I just think that's fascinating, you know, because I suppose these people are put on pedestals, or yeah, we put them in a certain place. And then when you meet them, it's like, oh, yeah, kind of like weird and quirky and kind of scary and, you know, odd, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is mad.
But he was, I mean, he was very human, actually. He was, he was kind of an alien, but then also quite human. And he came out to the port to wave goodbye to us and everything. It was kind of bizarre. And Michael took us back into town. And it was just one of those days. It was an extraordinary day. And he suddenly Michael went, oh, shit, I got to be somewhere. And he just opened the door of the car and we had to get out. And we were lost and we had 10 minutes to get the bus and we didn't know where we were. And this tiny little old lady pulled up in a long car. It's like a David Lynch kind of scene. And she said, you boys lost? And she took us to the station and we got on the bus. And there was nobody on the bus. And the bus driver said, you got the bus to yourselves, guys. And we went down to the back of the bus and we lit up a fag. And we just went, Jesus, that was the most extraordinary. And we were on again on to another 2 days journey to go to the East Coast. So it was just one of those days that you kind of go, it was actually like a movie.
Have you ever thought of writing that day? Or have you written
I wrote it as part of this kind of one-man thing, you know, that I did when I was a young lad. Like, I used to write and perform this thing. But I often think about it as a... You could take elements of what happened on the trip and make a kind of a coming-of-age story, and you'd make me a lot more interesting than I was or am. And you'd have a kind of a, you know, this kind of thing between these two friends who go off and have these extraordinary kind of on the road type experiences, you know.
Yeah. Hollywood would need for something really dark to happen at some point, you know, that you could.
Yes. There'd have to be some, big twist or plot thing or something, especially if it's Netflix or whoever, or the streaming sites are the only people who make dramas now anyway.
Yeah.
Would have to have something,
element of danger or something that you have to sort of get yourselves out of, you know, whether William turned the gun on you and decided, you know, got a bit dark or something. but I'm fascinated by Eden, and I will get onto the book, obviously, but I suppose it all comes from this. It was, I mean, for someone who left Edenderry at your age and then wrote this play about this couple, it was an incredible insight. I mean, for anybody who doesn't know, Eden is a play, essentially about a couple and their weekend in Edenderry, and there's drinking involved, and there's all sorts involved. Go and read it, go and buy it. I won't ruin it for you. But if you had an extraordinary insight into people who are older than you, had a different life than you, and obviously, you know, you were a young man leaving Edenderry, so it's not like you experienced, but maybe you did. Like, where did that come from?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose just kind of growing up in Edenderry, I went to school there. Like, I was sent to boarding school because we had a few bob. Like, we were the O'Briens of Edenderry. We had the supermarket. We had the, you know, it was all that. And we had the cinema, which was amazing because I spent an awful lot of time in the cinema as a child. And so I was very lucky that way. But so I was sent to school because all my father's father and everyone had gone to the school. I didn't think it was good. It wasn't for me anyway. And nothing wrong with the school. I just didn't like the life and the herd mentality in those places. I think it's not good for society as a whole, I think. Anyway, so I ran away. I said I'm out of here. So and that was a whole drama. Anyway, I was allowed back home and I went to the local school, and then I would have been in Edenderry a lot. I would have gone out in Edenderry a lot at nightclubs. I would have heard people talk, and I would have been in houses after, and I would have picked up on a lot of misery, you know, in ways, or people not able to communicate with each other, or so Eden came about because of kind of people you'd met, and it was based on people, but an amalgamation of loads of different people rather than one person, you know. But I'd been, you know, I knew all the nightclubs, knew all the you know, all the heads, the golf club, because the golf is a big thing in our family, both sides of our family. Everyone golfs, they're obsessed with golf. My brother Ken is the professional out in Edenderry Golf Club, and so we spent a lot of time in the golf club as kids. So the opening scene happens in a golf club, where the male character is out for a captain's night. But he wouldn't usually be there. It's his best friend, Tony, plays the golf, you know. And he's out there to spy on this young girl that he's kind of obsessed with. It all came out, like the Eden play I didn't even have a proper computer to write it on. I was living in a house full of actors. It was all kind of mad lifestyle. And I would lock the door and keep them out and be writing this thing at nighttime. Because I knew acting was only going to do so much for me. And I really wanted to do something, really wanted to write something. And this thing just kind of came out. It was like it was stored up there for, I was about 31 when I wrote it. So it just seemed to just come out. And there was a little bit of editing done when we brought it to the Abbey, but actually very little, really, I was very lucky. Conor McPherson was brought in to direct it, and he was absolutely amazing. And he was good. He was good at just suggesting a few things for it in terms of structure of it. But it just had this very smooth run. I didn't have to wait for years to get it on. It's just someone, I knew a guy. So I was lucky because I knew a lot of people in the industry. I was an actor, so I was able to get it to a lad in the Abbey, and he gave it to Ben Barnes, who was the artistic director at the time. And then he read it, and he called me, and I said, I think we're going to do this. I couldn't believe it, because usually you're on a stack of plays on a desk, and they have to go through them all. So it was just one of those. It was quite easy in the end, but I suppose you spend 15 years trying to get somewhere,
And then it just kind of, it was there just ready to be written. And I have a copy of it here with me. I wrote a one man play myself, a one man show recently. And
yes,
it is called Pure Mental.
Yes.
And it was Janet Moran directed it. And
yes, who's going to be in my show soon.
Yeah. And she advised me to get this book to read, because I suppose maybe the writing was similar. I grew up in the Midlands and Athlone or whatever, and it was about me growing up and all that kind of stuff. And I bought it, and then I realized I'd read it before and loved it, and I'd totally forgotten about it, and I still have the copy. But it was just, so obviously I feel like it informed how I wrote and then wrote the one-man show. So thank you very much for that. So Eden, so then you've got Scobie. So in the new book, going back, you've got Scobie coming back from Australia where he's been. So what was the difference between attacking the writing of that story in Eden Derry? Because the age of Scobie will be similar to the age of the characters in Eden, but things have moved on, times have changed, and I suppose Scobie has travelled. But there's still a lot of the same elements, as in, like, drink and mental health and all that kind of stuff. There's all those issues crop up as well. So what was the difference then?
I suppose, the big difference was that, Scobie is slightly old. The people in Eden were actually only in their early 30s.
Okay.
And I wanted them to be, now they're often, sometimes people have done it where they're much older, and it's actually kind of wrong. It's not middle-aged kind of all of that. It's not about that. It's just people who haven't really lived a life and are beginning to wake up to that fact and go, Jesus Christ, So Scobie's a very different character, because he never got, tied down. He didn't have responsibilities. He always lived his life on his terms, or so he thought. And he got out and he travelled and he was away for 10 years. He doesn't have children. So it's a very different, and he's also has a certain amount of trust in his own personality and how he gets on with people. And the two characters in Eden were very insecure people who probably didn't talk that much in real life. Actually, when we made the movie of it, they didn't talk that much, because they only talked a lot because they had an audience to talk to in the theatre, And they reported about loads of other people. They never really talked about themselves. They were very they were not self-aware, I think the woman has a growing self-awareness, but whereas Scobie does have a kind of a level of self-awareness, but there's something deep down at the root of him that is not right, and he's been pushing it down for years. And in this continuing story, in the book, we find out what it is, and we find out how he tries to in some way address it. So yeah,
and there are parallels there in that, like, the couple in Eden. I mean, there's a line that you, if I can remember it, but where the wife romanticizes his drunken advances, or his, you know, obviously, you know, him being drunk and kissing her and having sex or whatever, and she's romanticizing that, like, you know, creating this whole narrative around that, but there's nothing there really. And then
there's nothing there, and I think I always liked that kind of element of trying to go into people's fantasies and people, you know, their inner thoughts that they'd never tell anyone what they're telling us in the theater, you know, because we're God or whatever we are, they're in the confession and they have to tell us, you know, and it's the same, I suppose, the new play actually, Heaven, which is called Heaven, Eden, Heaven,
yeah,
is a mirroring of Eden, and it's an older couple who are in their early 50s from the same town. She's from the town, but the man isn't. He's from Limerick, and they're living in Limerick. And they're just back in the town for her sister's wedding.
Lovely. It
happens over this weekend at this wedding. And they have deep, dark desires that are, again, a lot of kind of fantasy that will come out in a very, I think it's a very different, it's very similar to Eden in one way, and then in another way, it's very different. It's a different kind of tone. And this couple are actually much, like, they fit together quite well. They're not like, Billy and Breed and Eden were kind of just fucking miserable, you know. These people aren't miserable. They've learned how to live with each other, and it's all grand. And they're quite self-aware about things, and they know the little compromises they make, and there's no sex anymore, but that's all right. And, you know, but actually there's something else going on in both of them that is, this weekend, they cannot ignore. And it all plays out. And I'm very excited about it, you know.
That's great. Did you say Janet is she's involved?
Janet's playing the woman in it. Like, there's a man and woman. It's the same thing as Eden, interlocking monologues. Andrew Bennett, who's a fantastic actor from Limerick. He's kind of known now for being the father in Colleen Kuhn.
Oh, yes.
Not the father, the old farmer that she goes to, you know, and he's amazing in that. So he's got this whole kind of new profile. And they're all talking Oscars to him and everything. He's going, "What are you talking about?" but he's brilliant, and he's playing the man, and Janet is playing the woman. So it's great, great cast, and we're starting rehearsal on Monday. So
wonderful. Well, look, tell Janet I said hello. Absolutely. I was going to say absolutely brilliant, helping me get the play done and written. She was absolutely. It wouldn't have happened probably without her. So you can tell her I said hello. So there's the whole thing between Eden and then the new play and this book is about, like, the things we don't tell other people, the fantasies, the things that we don't deal with, things that happen to us that we push down that we never actually deal with, and everything ultimately comes out somewhere.
I think a lot of my stuff is people's caught in a kind of a cycle, you know, caught in a behavioral cycle, and they can't quite get out of it, and usually using alcohol to soothe, you know, and so usually in my stuff it's either they find something gives, and they have to go to the blackest place before they can come up and try and find something, or they don't. And that's really, that's what kind of happens in everything I do. You know, on Pure Mule, it was the same. Each episode set around the weekend, and you kind of, did the weekend change their life or didn't it? Did they move on or didn't they, you know? But I'm very interested in that. And I think we all go through times in our life where we are stuck and can't get on, and are very... miserable and depressed, and God knows what it's about. But sometimes you have to go to the bad place to come out and ask for a bit of help, you know?
I mean, I had a very similar experience in my 40s where there was a sort of an event that led me to go to therapy and figure everything out and realize what was important and what was real. And And, you know, it was probably, it was a tough time, best thing that ever happened to me. But, and do you have an experience that sort of feeds into Scobie's, the story of Scobie?
Like slightly, I mean, Scobie's turns 40 in the book, but I found the 40s difficult. I think men find the 40s difficult. We go into a tunnel. I would call it the tunnel. And we were stuck there. We're afraid of the future. We haven't quite sorted ourselves out. I don't know. There's old demons going on. And you think you're a failure at things, or you haven't achieved like all the things you wanted to. And it's all that kind of stuff. I found the 40s quite difficult. And I found turning 40 difficult. I mean, before that, I had gone to see a counsellor when I just turned 40. I decided I was going to try and stop drinking for a while, because I felt I was drinking too much. Like, I wasn't like, you know, crazy, but I did feel it had a hold on me. And things were going really well. You know what I mean? Everything was going fantastic. And Pure Mew was all this big hit, and we were going to, Eden had been just shot and made, and we had high hope, you know, we had great hopes for it, and the movie version and all that. Right. So, but I just hit a wall, and so one Monday morning, I just got a phone book, the Yellow Pages out, and I went down to see who I'd, I just randomly got a counsellor lad out in suburb of Dublin, and I went out to him. And he was very nice. And we didn't make any huge breakthroughs. It wasn't The Sopranos, but, you know, we just sat. But it was by virtue of the fact of telling someone something and talking about yourself. And also, it meant that you if you told someone you weren't drinking, you kind of felt you couldn't drink, you know. So it was good. And I didn't drink for about 2 years around that. And it was a really good thing to do, actually.
I did very similar. I haven't drank in about 2.5 years now myself. I'd love to know what the reintroduction of drink was like to your life, because I've kind of said to my wife, I was like, oh, maybe when I'm 50 I'll drink, and then I'll drink till I'm 60, so I'll give myself 10 years of drinking, you know. But similar to you, I wasn't drink didn't affect my work or my life, but I just felt maybe I'd like to sort of give it up.
I went back. I was actually in a film festival in Holland. There's this wonderful little film festival, and all the smaller film festivals are great because they really make a fuss out of you if you go, you know. The bigger ones, you just get lost. You get out of the way, you know. But anyway, we were at this, and there was a great dinner, and we'd been there for 2 days, and there was three of us on, my partner at the time and an actress called Sarah Green, who the two of them had gone out the night before and partied with all the Dutch people, and was all, you know. And I went to the bed. I went to a late night screening, and then I went to bed real early. And the next day, then we were at this huge dinner, and it was amazing. It was all different wines and champagnes, and like, and I just said, you know, something. So I just took up a glass of champagne, and it was the nicest drink I ever had in my life. It was so beautiful, you know. And then that was it. But I've drank since, and never, it just hasn't had the same hold as it did before.
You've kind of broke the spell or something, or
yeah, and I'm able to leave it now. Physically, I'm not able for it anyway, so that's good, you know.
Yeah.
So I choose my battles now, as someone once said. You know, if it's a proper occasion, I'll go for it. You know.
Yeah.
But I'm happy just to have a couple of glasses with the dinner kind of thing, you know.
Good, good, good.
But it did have a grip, you know.
Yeah, and I think like a lot of this stuff that you write about, like it, and I think of Eden Derry. Like, I grew up in Athlone. I moved to Newbridge, you know, so similar size small towns. I mean, Athlone obviously is bigger than Eden Derry, but you know that Midlands thing, and that drink thing as well, and that. That inability for, especially for men, and I suppose for women as well, to deal with emotion and to deal with life and to deal with, you know, where they should be at a certain age and why they're not, and, you know, why they're married to who they're married to and who they should be married to, and, you know, loss and all that kind of stuff, and death. Yeah. And it's all just, but it's all there. It's all in the stuff. But, it, like, you know, drink is so... And I often say, like, I would never be judgmental and judge people who drink, because it's a lot of the time it's the medication that actually will get you through.
Yeah.
You know, that and sort of like, until you're ready, it'll keep you from having to face up to what you need to face up to, you know?
Absolutely. Totally. And, yeah. And you know, and you, and like, it's, I've had the best times of my life drinking. And the worst, but you know what I mean. It's as Homer Simpson says, whatever. It's alcohol. It's the cause and solution to all of life's problems, whatever he says. But and yeah, so I was very interested to go into that again. I mean, when Scobie in the book, when he comes back from Australia, he has a particularly horrific experience in Australia, and so he's off. He's trying to not drink when he gets home, which he finds incredibly difficult because the whole thing runs on drink. You know what I mean? It's so difficult. And so he slowly kind of gets back into it, but then he goes into even a deeper hole, which was, is medication, is antidepressants and all that. So we wanted to go down that road with him and how addictive they are and how hard it is to get off them. And, you know, and he goes pretty, I drive him to the edge. I mean, there was a moment when I was writing the book where he started doing something that I didn't think he was going to do. This is a great thing when it happens. You know, it happens every now and again with writers where the character is leading you. And he was doing something quite kind of insane, really. And, I went, Jesus Christ. And I was like, the woman who was facing the mad behavior was shocked in the story. And I was shocked as the writer. You know, I was kind of going, I've known this guy for 20 years. He's never behaved like this. Like, Scobie never goes on like this, like, you know. But he anyway, and I knew, Jesus, this is where we have to bring him. This is actually, he's actually going to kind of lose his mind. So that was interesting. And then how do we get him, bring him back from that? And so I think the book goes into interesting areas there. I think up front, it's a really great read. It's like, it's a pure mule episode. There's loads of different characters, especially the women in his life, you know, they kind of get chapters of their own from their perspective, because his mother and his ex-lover, Deirdre, was married to the sergeant, and he had famously had sex with her one time. He gave her ecstasy tablets and they had sex, but she is now has a gambling addiction on the phone, you know, which is such a huge thing. I had done some research on that for another project and was just absolutely amazed with what the gambling companies can do. But anyway, so that's all that plot. But it's like a kind of pure mule thing where Scobie's getting involved with all these lives, and really it's trying to distract from his own shit, do you know what I mean? But then once he's faced with that, he has to go into his own soul or whatever. The book goes into another kind of area, which I think is kind of interesting, you know?
Yeah, no, it's so many themes. Like, that's the thing about the book. Like, it touches on so many. Like, and initially at the start, like, there's so many, you're setting it up, so many moments. Like, and even the way he talks about drink at the start, it's very light. Like, because he's just like, it's almost like he's just not drinking that weekend. You know, he doesn't tell, and you don't know the reason he's given up. And it's just very like,
yeah,
you know, the first mention of it really is when he thinks about the bottle of whiskey downstairs that Cliff has, and he's like, oh man, wouldn't mind the smell of that or whatever. And that's just, yeah. But it's very light at the start. You know, you don't really think there's any issue there. And then it's sort of like, and then he meets the girl, his dear daughter, and she's been, you know, she's been encouraged to get into a car with the sergeant or whatever. And,
yeah,
you know, there's all these little things being set up, and but so many themes being dealt with then throughout, and you know, being resolved and all that kind of stuff. And then he gets into the Xanax and all that kind of stuff. But I really like, I mean, we talked about alcohol here, but there's so much more going on, and we really are as a nation focused on the alcohol, and, you know, whether it's great or whether it's bad. And meanwhile, people are people whose lives are wrecked because of the medication they're getting off their doctor, or the thing they're gambling they're doing on their phone, or the relationship they can't, the emotion they've never been taught how to use. You know, there's so many other issues that, and you're dealing with them here, and it's real. And I would encourage men to read this book, especially, you know, because, you know, this is an example of what can happen to you, and it does happen to you, and you know, you do need to deal with this stuff, or it'll deal with you, you know.
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. And
I mean, ultimately, you're writing an entertaining book, and it's a great story. There's loads in there, you know.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That was the aim with this, that it would be like a good story. It would be easy to read. It would be, you know, I wouldn't be experimenting with, you know, I wouldn't be, you know, William Burroughs on this one. But, you know, it's kind of fairly straightforward written. It's popular fiction. And that suited the world and the story. And it was still tough to do. I mean, I went down a few holes with it, but I had great help, as I said. I had a great editor, and just in terms of structuring a book, you know what I mean. It's a kind of different ball game than drama.
It does go back and forth, doesn't it?
Which is much more like a book. You go back and forth, and whereas I had done more kind of chronological, where I actually had started in Australia, and there was a lot more of Australia in it originally, because they'd asked me for two sample chapters before they, you know, they ask you to do something, and then they want to see, can you, you know, put some kind of English down on paper? So you have to do two chapters, and the two chapters were opening two chapters in Australia, where we find out why he left. This horrific thing that happened, that this experience he had, and so that was the first thing the editor said was, you're giving that all away too early, and you save it and eke it out, you know, throw the crumbs of bread out throughout the book. So we did that, and it was her ideas also to give the women their own chapters, that to take the burden of narrative off Scobie, that you would give the mother, who's very intrinsic to the book, his mother and Deirdre, the other character, that they would have their own perspectives, two chapters each, and that really helped take the load off Scobie, you know, because there was so many problems befalling him. At one stage I was going, my God, I'm loading every contemporary, and I wasn't trying to do issues. Like, I hate issue dramas, you know. And some of them are really well done, but you know that thing where you're only really watching it because it's an issue thing, and it's slightly finger wagging you, and it's slightly kind of saying, "Don't do this, don't do that." And there's a lot of it around at the moment, especially in theatre. But I was getting a bit worried that it was too issue based, and so we wanted to distract away from Scobie a little bit. So, but you know, as I say, it was a great learning curve, the whole thing.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, sometimes I'd watch something like Fargo. I don't know if you've seen the series of Fargo, and, you know, everything's so far-fetched and fantastical and insane, you know, that. And then you kind of hear about a story of someone who might have lived two doors up from you, and something crazy and mental has happened to them. But you didn't really know what was going on at the time. And then you realize that these stories aren't that fantastical or insane, that these happen. People don't talk about them. They happen behind closed doors, or they happen within, you know, a community of people, or the golf club, or the GAA club, or whatever, and it all stays within that. You never find out of it, but it is, that's real life, you know.
Totally, everybody goes through extraordinary things in their life. Everyone has extraordinary inner thoughts that they'll never tell anyone. Like, there's no such thing as the ordinary man in the street, or that term, or there's no such thing as that character's only there to, you know, some. Time if you're mentoring people or teaching writing or whatever, you know, they just write a character as a cipher for, you know, it has to be there for a reason. They have to have a full life. They have to have, you know, everything going on. So, you know, absolutely. There's people have so much stories, and you're just trying to take the roof off the house and look in and put the roof back.
That's,
you know,
lovely.
Just people are going through so much stuff, and, you know, so much joy as well, and so much happiness, and people have incredible resilience, and they keep going, and they've children. And I don't have kids. I don't know how people have children and how they do it. And it's just amazing. So,
but that's the thing, is like, this is why. And I interviewed Mark O'Halloran about when his movie Rialto came out.
Yes.
He's had a great phrase. He said, men have a terrible habit of backing themselves into a corner, you know? You know, that they just can't, everything's grand until it's not, only is it not grand
absolutely.
Anymore.
No, we'll put it off, we'll put it off, we'll put it off, we'll put it off. And then, you know,
it's a catastrophe.
We'll do everything really bar talk about it. I mean, men, I think, are getting better at talking about stuff. But we will tend to want to avoid it at all costs.
And that's the thing. We're constantly comparing ourselves to these people who we see live two doors up and have the perfect life, you know. And none of it is true. So, you know,
they're looking at you going, look at that bollock down there. He's got it made. You know what I mean? So it's all of that. Totally. And then, you know, you don't want to be seen asking for help or different, you know, the shame of it. The shame is such a huge thing in this country and always has been, and was kind of, you know, the church weaponized it. And there's still a lot of shame around mental health and all of that stigma. It's a real stigma still, you know.
Totally, and asking for help and all that kind of stuff. The book is called Going Back. And it's Scobie Donoghue's return to Edenderry. And yeah, look, I would encourage anyone to buy it. It's just a brilliant story. And as you said, like, it's a page turner, you know, easy to read, but very dramatic. Loads of stuff going on. Loads of people you can identify with. And like, I know I've mentioned the learnings and all that kind of stuff, you know, but it's not that either. It's everything, you know. And I really loved it. So I'd highly recommend it. Obviously, I'd say that to your face, you know.
I know. Can you get off this now when you say all sorts?
Sure.
But no, that is great to hear, because, you know, not many people have really read it yet, so it's great to hear.
Yeah, well, I'm very privileged and delighted and a big fan as well, and looking forward to heaven as well. And
great.
So when is that? When's that going to be on stage?
Heaven will be on. It starts October 6th in the Dublin Theatre Festival. It's on Blanchardstown, four shows. Then it's Dunleary Pavilion for six shows the next week. And then it's doing a kind of a short enough tour around the country. I think we're going to seven venues, the Hawkswell and Sligo and Kilkenny and Waterford and Limerick and Galway and I think that's and Cork.
Brilliant.
So I think it's one night stands everywhere except Cork and Limerick have two shows. So it'll be around, and then we're going to New York in January, which is to an Irish festival, an off-Broadway house there that Fishamble have great contact with. So we're going to go there for 3 weeks and we'll see what happens. Hopefully, you know, who knows?
Yeah, well, I think go and see it now before it's...
And see it now, absolutely, and book now. And
then you can tell everyone, I went to see that play before it got, before it went to Broadway.
Yes.
Listen, thanks a million for your time, and I really enjoyed talking to you. The William Burroughs story was a bonus.
You didn't expect that one.
Came out of nowhere. I loved it.
That's great.
Best of luck with the rest of the promo for the book and with the book and the play and everything. And thanks for chatting to me.
Thank you so much, Keith. Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.